Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Marshall Poe, the editor-in-chief of the network, and each week, as you know, we scoured the internet looking for interesting books, and we interview the authors of those books. And this week, I'm very pleased to say we have my colleague Jen Sessions on the show, and we'll be talking about her terrific book, By Sword and Plow, France and the Conquest of Algeria. This book answers a question that I've had for a long time, and that is, how the heck did the French get in Algeria? I just did not know, but Jen does a wonderful job of telling us how they got there and why they stayed with such great persistence, I should say. So, Jen, thank you for writing the book, and welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Okay, so could you begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Well, as you know, I'm a historian of modern France. I'm interested primarily in two overlapping sets of questions. One is the history of France and its relationship to the rest of the world, particularly its colonies and former colonies, and the relationships between politics and culture in the modern world. And these are questions that I've sort of been with me for a long time. I did my undergraduate degree at Harvard in the wonderful history and literature major, where I was encouraged and, in fact, required to think about the relationship between culture and history through the lens of literature. But also was encouraged to think about a lot of the things that ended up in this book, art history, the history of music, the history of the press, and those relationships. And I came to the study of France in particular because I grew up in a very Francophile household. My father was a teacher of French. My parents had lived in France when they were graduate school age. And I had been fascinated as a young student of France, even back in high school, by the legacies of the French Empire that were cropping up in the world of the late 20th century, and particularly debates about the veil and the place of Muslim immigrants in modern France. And so even as an undergraduate, I started using my coursework to try and figure out how we got to that that point. And then I went off after doing my undergraduate degree to a PhD in history at the University of Pennsylvania on the advice of a wonderful undergraduate advisor who said that the historians would let me play more with the literature and the art than the literature people would let me play with the archives. So I became a historian rather than a literary critic. And then picked up with the questions that I had there.
I see. So let's jump right into the book. I should also tell our listeners that I know that Jen has a very beloved dog, and that dog traveled with her to France, where she is now from Iowa, and that dog is in her lap. So this
True.
Is simply
you,
the,
you may hear her a little bit.
This is the cost of doing business with great historians. Sorry, that's unavoidable. We'll have the dog in the lap. So let's get right to it. How did the French end up in Algeria?
How did the French end up in Algeria? The short answer is that they ended up in Algeria as a consequence of having lost the colonies that they had had in the early modern period to the combined forces of international diplomacy and war and revolution.
And they sold some of them, honest. They sold them, you know, just, right?
Louisiana, for example.
Yeah, right. They just sold it.
although they were probably going to lose Louisiana anyway, and right. So the sale was way to
they were motivated
make sure
sellers,
it ended up in the right hands rather than than the wrong hands. But yes, indeed, you know, Americans have the collapse of the early modern French Empire to thank for much of the Midwest and the Central South. But the loss of this empire that came along with a questioning of the ways that empire had been done in the early modern period. An empire that had been based on restrictive trade relations, on chattel slavery, on plantation agriculture, that under the intellectual influence of the Enlightenment, under the political influence of the French Revolution, came to be considered unacceptable for a modern state. And so they set out, on the one hand, looking for colonies, because colonies are something that great states have, because military conquest is something that great political leaders do, and the French rulers of the post-revolutionary period had lots of anxiety about whether they were great rulers. They had been brought back as kings after the French Revolution, and in a context where people didn't take having a king for granted anymore, and they needed a way to legitimize themselves. Mm-hmm. So they looked to military conquest to help do that. And in the end, discovered that war in Europe was going to be a bad idea. So overseas seemed like a good place to have the war that you needed politically. And Algeria became the object of that ambition, partly by happenstance. The French government in the 1820s got involved in a series of diplomatic disputes with the government of Algiers, which was at the time a province of the Ottoman Empire, although fairly autonomous in its operations. And the French had owed the Algiers Regency some money dating back to the French Revolution, and they got in some arguments about the repayment of that debt in the late 1820s. The king of France at that time, a guy called Charles X, who was extremely unpopular, he was quite reactionary. There's the dog, Irving. Quite reactionary, and needed some political help at home, and this diplomatic dispute with Algiers gave him a pretext for starting a war overseas that he hoped would sort of save the government in France and help save the monarchy. So in the spring of 1830, when the political crisis of the French monarchy was reaching its height, Charles X sent an army to North Africa to punish supposedly the North African government for violating diplomatic protocols, for violating trade. There was a big concern on the French end about the Barbary pirates who were operating out of Algerian ports, or had been. There was not very much piracy left by the 1820s, but they had been operating out of there in the early modern period. So Charles X sends an army and conquers Algiers, and it doesn't save him. The French get their victory over Algiers on the 5th of July, 1830, and on the 27th of July, the population of Paris rose up in revolution and overthrew Charles X. But his successor, his cousin, a guy called Louis Philippe, stayed in Algeria, and that's really one of the big questions. Once the invasion of 1830 had taken place, for political reasons that turned out not to be successful, why stay? The conquest and the occupation were incredibly expensive. Monetarily, they were quite costly in terms of French lives, and of course even more costly in terms of Algerian lives, and politically contentious. So the question then became, why why did they stay? And not only why did they stay, but why did they invest an enormous amount in turning Algeria into a settler colony as opposed to simply a military territory, an occupied territory, or a colony of commercial exploitation and trade, but into a place where the goal was to resettle the land with emigrants from France, which is exactly what the July Monarchy government that came in 1830 did.
Mm-hmm.
And
well,
what I found. Oh, go ahead.
I'm sorry, just to put this in context, this was a relatively unusual thing to do late in the day. That is to create a colony where you implanted your own people. This was a good thing to do in the 16th and 17th centuries, and a lot of European states did it. But by the 19th century, it really wasn't done very. In fact, I'm trying to think of another instance. I know that, well, the Russians were sending lots of Russians into the Ukraine, or Ukraine,
yes,
as we now call it.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of another example. I don't know.
Well, there actually are quite a few, and that's one of the really interesting things that I found when I started to look into this was that the French were actually not the only ones doing this in the middle of the 19th century. The 1832 was the first year that the French really start to open up some of the territory in North Africa to civilian settlement. It's actually the same year that the British start allowing free emigration to Australia.
Good point.
The development of settlement in South Africa, eventually the opening up of the Western United States. This really is a phenomenon, actually, of the middle of the 19th century, and it turns out that that the French were part of a much bigger transnational, what I've come to think of as settler movement of the 19th century, and in terms of the broader history of European and Western empires, there is this very interesting stage in the middle of the 19th century from, you know, the 1820s, but really about 1830 through the 1880s and 1890s, where the old empire of particularly slavery and plantation agriculture is increasingly called into question, both economically and morally. And the new imperialism, the big expansion of the late 19th century, hasn't come on the scene yet with ideas about, you know, economic exploitation at something of a remove. And there's this half century in the middle of the 1800s where most colonial powers are engaged in, or imperial powers are engaged in, some form of settler colonization. You mentioned the Russians. The Austrians are trying to settle the eastern part of their territories. As I said, the United States is beginning to try and colonize the Midwest. So there really is actually this sort of huge moment in the middle of the 19th century that's characterized by an idea that this would be a form of empire that could be economically and socially productive, would create morally stable communities of families and permanent settlers rather than speculators and people who are just going out for a short period of time to make a lot of money and then leave, without slaves. So you have, you know, European immigrants doing labor, at least in theory, instead of African slaves. So this is the idea, and at the same time, you're going to help solve social problems that are arising in Europe and in the more densely populated parts of the eastern United States by the process of industrialization and the urbanization that went along with that. So people start to look around in the 1820s and see cities are growing. People are migrating from the countryside into the urban areas looking for work in new kinds of factories. And this is very, very worrisome to people who care about the moral and the social health of their societies. There's, you know, this seems to come along with crime and prostitution and all kinds of revolution, things that are bad for social stability. And so settlement colonization seems to offer a solution to that problem.
Mm-hmm.
Too, you can take the people who are causing trouble, or the people who would cause trouble if they came to the city, and send them instead overseas, where not only will they not be clogging up your cities, but they'll also be working in agriculture instead of in factories. And the social theorists who are interested in this, which ranges from, liberal political economists inspired by Adam Smith to utopian socialists and Sansomonians. It's really across the spectrum. Politically, they think that agriculture is a much better way to make a living, much better morally, much better socially, much better personally, than to be a wage laborer in someone else's
mm-hmm.
factory.
Mm-hmm.
And so settlement colonization offers you the possibility of both creating a new kind of empire, but also solving your domestic problems mm-hmm. as well.
I guess the distinction I was trying to grasp at, and unsuccessfully, because you've convinced me that there is this thing, is one between colonization of areas that are very lightly populated and by really traditional people, usually hunter-gatherers, and here I'm talking about the American Midwest mm-hmm. and Australia and South Africa, and a place like Algeria, which is the farthest thing from that, as far as I understand. I mean, it was an mm-hmm. old, very well-settled, very well-established Ottoman colony. It was part of the caliphate. This would be like, I guess this was like one European power in the broader sense colonizing another. And you see the distinction I'm making? It wasn't.
Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And this is certainly something that people who are critical of the French occupation of Algeria pointed out, that there had been a state in North Africa that the French had engaged in regime change,
mm-hmm.
that the French had dismantled, that there were, long-standing, highly developed societies in North Africa, and that this made Algeria different from some of these other places. But again, I guess I tend to see the similarities more than the differences. The people who are advocating for French colonization in Algeria put a great deal of energy, intellectual and political energy, into convincing themselves and convincing other people, convincing policymakers that in fact the society in North Africa that the French had found was not a real civilization. That
mm-hmm.
that the Algerians, despite the fact that there were big cities. Algiers is a fairly significant urban settlement. There are Constantine, Oran. There are other cities clearly identifiable in North Africa. But nonetheless, the French scientists and the military officials who are active in North Africa are convinced that the population is just nomads,
right?
And pastoralists, that they are not in fact making the use of the land that they should.
Right, but that's false. But that's false. I mean, isn't that false? I mean, I seem to remember reading about how like Algeria supplied France with huge amounts of grain even before 1830.
Yeah, that's actually the source of the debt that creates the pretext for the invasion is that the Algerians sold grain to the French armies in Spain during the Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars.
This seems to me like Orientalism with teeth. We're just going to say these people are really primitive because it pleases us to do so.
Right. Yeah. Although I think the same could be said about what happens in Australia or the United States as well. These are not, in fact, empty.
No, they're
land.
Not empty.
The cultivation of the land is different from what Europeans would recognize.
They're certainly not empty, right? But they certainly don't have a tradition of 2,000 years of civilization going back to the Romans that they can call on. I'm certainly not saying that any of this colonization was a good thing. It was all a bad thing. But I'm just trying to like understand the French mindset in going into a place that does have this 2,000-year-old tradition, was an autumn province, and people highly literate. I don't know if they had the, you know, sort of the Muslim equivalent of universities. They certainly had advanced agriculture. And this was not, you know, like, you know, going on to the plains of Iowa, and you know, this, it just wasn't like that. So, but anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I think, I mean, there are a couple of really important differences that translate into some of what you're talking about. I think the first thing I would say is that one of the things that makes a big difference in the long term between Algeria and other sites of settler colonization is the disease environment. The fact that Algeria is part of a Mediterranean world that has been linked together for centuries, if not millennia, through trade, through earlier military interactions, diplomacy, means that European germs, European pathogens aren't as foreign in North Africa as they are in Australia or in North America. And so the decimation of the population by disease that goes such a long way to convincing you know, the British basically that nobody lives in North America, nobody lives in Australia. That kind of genocide by disease doesn't happen in North Africa because you know, people have been exposed to the germs before. And so the impact of the French conquest and the French occupation demographically is catastrophic in the sense that you know, from the invasion of 1830 to the mid 1850s, the Algerian population is reduced by almost half, from about 4 million to the best we can estimate now to under 2.5 million people. But that mostly comes from rising mortality rates from disease because of other kinds of dislocations related to the war, particularly the disruption of food supplies. And so people are more vulnerable to disease than they had been before. But they're not encountering those diseases for the very first time and just dying off en masse. The other thing about that history that you mentioned is that actually ends up giving the French or being seized on by the French as a weapon to use against Algerians. That Roman history in particular, the French, you know, going back to Louis XIV, have liked to see themselves as the you know, the heirs of the Roman Empire in the modern world, right? The Paris is the new Rome. Right. The French monarchs are the new emperors. They're going to bring civilization, the most advanced civilization in the world, to everybody else. And that prevails into the 19th century, and you find archaeologists, artists, even, you know, reconnaissance officers in the French army marching around Algeria looking at these Roman ruins. It's, you know, full of Roman ruins.
It is.
Or the remains of the Phoenician occupation, and saying, you know, look, the Arab population that arrived after the Romans, they have not maintained the civilization that was here. And so we, as the proper heirs of Rome, have a duty to take up that earlier civilizing mission.
Right,
here.
The civilizing mission. Yes, that's the phrase I was trying
mission.
To get. It's the famous civilizing mission. So they're going to go civilize these. What are really these? I don't exactly know what to call them. Algerians, Muslims, members of the Caliphate, Ottoman subjects. They're going to civilize these people. I got. I'm saying that with a smile on my face because they were already civilized.
yeah, and there is, you know, this is definitely part of the project. Although that's actually not the part that I have been as much interested in, because a lot of, you know, very good historians have been studying that civilizing mission as it pertains to the indigenous Algerian population, whether in the form of the institution of educational, a new educational system or new legal system, and so on. But there's another part of the civilizing mission that really serves that purpose of settlement colonization, which is that they're going to civilize, or the French see themselves as civilizing, not just the people, and in fact, I would argue early on, they're less interested in civilizing the people than they are in civilizing the land itself,
mm-hmm.
and restoring what they saw as the granary of Rome. They're always talking about the granary of Rome,
mm-hmm.
Restoring the land to its former levels of productivity through the institution of European style agriculture by European immigrants.
Mm-hmm. So one question I had along the agricultural lines is, if you're going to colonize a place with agriculturalists and there are already agriculturalists there,
mm-hmm.
what happens to the people who are already there?
Indeed. This is one of the great questions of the 19th century in colonial Algeria is how do we, the French said is, how do they deal with the land question? And the answer in its very short version is you kick them off their land.
Yeah,
you kick indigenous Algerians off their land. Because the French are concerned about appearances to a certain extent, and I think sincerely at some level, they try to make distinctions between land that is owned by individuals or groups of people and land that belongs to the state. Because in the capitulation of the Day of Algiers in 1830, the property of the Regency of Algiers had been transferred mm-hmm. to the French state. The French say, okay, now everything that belonged to the Day and to the Day's government belongs to the French state. So they spent a lot of time in the first two or three decades trying to figure out who owns what. And what belongs to the state and what belongs to particular people. And because much of the landholding in Algeria prior to the French arrival was in some form of communal ownership or use rights held in common, the verification of titles, of land titles, means that lots of people end up losing the rights to their land. The French just don't recognize the forms of ownership that existed. They're looking for something that looks like, what they recognize as private land ownership. And these various forms of communal property don't meet those criteria. And then, the French is a very bureaucratic state. They want people to be able to prove that they own something. So they ask people to show, paper land titles. We want a document that says, an official document that says you own this land, or we won't recognize your land rights. And, the Ottoman state, the Deylikal state, had not been those kinds of bureaucratic states, and so a lot of people didn't have the kind of paper that would convince the French, and so they were, mm-hmm. lost their land rights. And then when that process begins to die down and the French still want land and the growing settler population wants more land, then they start saying, okay, well, are you making use of the land? A given part of a given tribe has, 20,000 hectares of land, and a population of this many thousand. You don't really, if you were using the land right, you wouldn't need that much land to support that population. And
right.
So we will decide scientifically, how much land you need per person. using, you know, modern agricultural methods. And so we will then give you that much land and take the rest for the state to be redistributed to European immigrants. Or we'll take all of your land and then give you another area of land equivalent to what we think you need somewhere else, because we actually, you know, we think that the land that, that you have now is really good for European settlement. So there are a whole variety of mechanisms by which the land is seized for European settlement, but the end result is just massive expropriation of Algerian land rights and the redistribution of land to settlers. And this really is, you know, in many ways, the fundamental fact of settlement colonization that makes it different from other kinds of colonial domination.
And the memory of this, the memory of this doesn't really go away, does it?
No, yeah, absolutely not.
And it comes absolutely back to bite not. The French in the hindquarters.
It does. I mean, partly, you know, there is a very dramatic and very rapid reversal of the process at the end of the French period, at the end of the Algerian War of Independence in 1962. Almost all of the European settler population leaves Algeria in a matter of months. There are about 1 million Europeans in Algeria by the early 1960s, and they almost all leave in the spring and summer of 1962, and their, you know, apartments, houses, farms are occupied by local people or seized by the now independent Algerian state for rationalization and reuse, because the independent state is at least for a period a socialist state.
So let me ask this: who went? How did they recruit people to go to Algiers and Algeria? And do we know anything about them demographically speaking?
These are some of the questions that I was really trying to answer in the book, because we know surprisingly little about the French who emigrated to Algeria. We knew some global demographic things about the European population. We knew rough numbers that the population from basically zero in 1830 by 1850 is up to 125,000 by 1890 is up to 880,000. We know how much the population grew. We knew that through the most of the 19th century, the majority of the European population was actually not French. They were European immigrants from places in the southern Mediterranean, from Spain, from Italy, from Malta, and the Balearic Islands. So we knew these things. And people had studied the recruitment of migrants in Spain and in Italy and Germany even and Switzerland. But we didn't really know much about what was going on in France to recruit that half of the European population that was from France. So I set out to try and find the mechanisms. And it turned out that the archives were not very helpful. although there was an office in Paris and an office in Algiers that were in charge of emigration and settlement, the way that the papers, the physical papers of the archives had been moved around over the course of the colonial period and then brought back to France also fairly suddenly at the end of the colonial period, meant that there was no continuous record of those offices' operations. And so I could not just sit down and go through and say, okay, the second bureau of the Direction of the Interior in the Government General of Algeria is in charge of colonization, so this is what they did. So I had to piece together what I could find of those activities from the general archives of the colonial government in Algiers. And then I ended up actually going to local archives in France, to see where, to the places where people had come from, to see what they could tell me about who these people were and how they got there. So I did find in the colonial archives a set of registers, which are French term like for you know, books, just rolls where bureaucrats make lists of things in order just over a long period of time, continuously. Mm-hmm. And I found a set of registers that had survived from the middle of the 1840s that had that told me the names and the professions and the hometowns of about 20,000 people who had migrated from France to Algeria in the 1820s or who had been given assistance by the state to migrate to Algeria. And so I spent many, many months with lots of help from some research assistants, entering all this into a database to figure out kind of in the aggregate who they were. And that gave me some professional information. You know, they ended up being mostly unskilled workers, people who could, you know, work in construction for the most part, and to a lesser extent in agriculture, but they were mostly people who were needed for construction because the state was trying to build everything from government offices to barracks to villages for agricultural settlers to live in. So that was sort of one really interesting thing, that the preference that the officials were expressing for agricultural settlers, you know, people who are going to live and work on the land. When you looked at who the state was actually helping to emigrate to Algeria, it was not those people at all. It was people who live in cities, people who do urban kinds of labor. So that was one thing that I found in the aggregate. The other thing I found was the geography of migration, and probably the thing in the book that took the most time and effort to put together is a map that shows up in the last chapter of the geographical origins of the migrants from these registers. It took forever, and I was able to shade in the different areas. And what you found was a sort of real concentrations in urban areas in eastern France, in Alsace and Lorraine along the German border, where Strasbourg, one of the biggest cities in France, is located, and then in and around Paris itself, which and between the two of them, Strasbourg and Paris ended up accounting for almost half of the assisted migrants of the early 1840s. And then there was a lesser concentration in the southwest along the Spanish border. So I started trying to figure out, you know, what it was about these places that had encouraged people to leave. It meant that more people left from there than from other places. And it turned out that it was not necessarily poverty, although economic problems certainly played a role, but it was local traditions of migration. When you started to look, you know, down at the lowest levels of the data, people were emigrating very often from cities to which they had already emigrated from somewhere else, or where many people were moving in and out. So these were coming from mobile places with lots of migration going in and out. Mm-hmm. They were coming a very, very surprisingly high degree from administrative centers from the capitals of the departments or the capitals of the smaller administrative districts, which meant they were people who were being reached by government propaganda and recruitment efforts. So when the minister in Paris sent, you know, things like posters out to the provinces to say, you know, we're looking for people who want to emigrate to Algeria, and here we'll give you a free passage, and we'll give you some help with your travel expenses, and we'll give you the opportunity to work on a public works project when you get there, or to get a concession of land and start a farm. These are the people who are most likely to see those posters. So that's sort of how the mechanism worked, but it never worked quite well enough. The French authorities were always very concerned that, you know, despite their best efforts, there were not enough people emigrating to Algeria. Mm-hmm. That although the population was, the European population was growing steadily, it wasn't growing fast enough, and that the people who were going were the wrong kinds of people, and they were particularly concerned about urban workers, people who were assumed to be poor, to have skills that were not well adapted to pioneer life in a colony, and would be sources of disorder, because of course they assume that, you know, poor people are, you know, more likely to drink, more likely to have children out of wedlock, more likely to live in common law marriages and do all of the things that you know, middle class social reformers and government bureaucrats don't like. And then they were concerned about speculators, about people who are going to speculate in kind of petty trades, particularly various forms of selling alcohol to the French army, which was growing just as fast as the European civilian population in the 1830s and 1840s, selling alcohol to the soldiers, selling alcohol to the colonists, and generally corrupting life. They spend a lot of time counting bars and counting cafes and so forth, and discovering that, you know, in fact, according to official statistics in the 1840s, alcohol is the single largest trade good in Algeria, in occupied Algeria. So they're concerned about people speculating there. You know, they're just going to do the thing that's going to make them the most money and then go off back to where they came from. Or people speculating in land and you know, people who would either get concessions or buy land or trick Algerians into selling them the land and then not use it, not cultivate it, not settle it with, you know, small tenant farmers, but just sit on it, waiting for it to appreciate, and then mm-hmm. sell it at a profit without doing anything productive. Mm-hmm. So there's concern that there's not enough people, it's the wrong kind of people, and so they use the local administrators in France to try and recruit the right sort of immigrants. They try and do kind of a propaganda campaign using the illustrated press of the period. The 1830s is kind of the moment that kind of a mass popular press starts to come on the scene in Europe, and particularly illustrated weekly magazines. The London Illustrated News is the first of these, and the French found their own versions of that in the late 1830s and early 1840s. And so these are magazines that are intended to be educational. They're supposed to give, you know, working class, lower middle class readers, you know, educational, moral and healthy reading material, so they don't read novels. Are there things that are, you know, suspect in various ways. So the French government starts to work with the publisher of the two main illustrated newspapers in France to try and spread a positive message about Algeria. They think people may fear that because the French army is fighting a great war of conquest, that it's dangerous to move to Algeria. So they're trying to reassure them that no, it's not. The land is very fertile. You don't even have to work very hard to make your fields produce enormous amounts of crops. And this is something that is, it's a great thing for France and, mm-hmm. and by implication for French people.
Mm-hmm. So what did, let me ask this really quickly. What enticed settlers to go there? What did they think they were getting into, and what did they actually get?
Well, that's, I think I can tell you a little bit more about the former than the latter at this point. The first book, because it really was focused on the French end of the migration stream, didn't get to the question of opening up, what happened to people once they got there beyond the most general. But what people thought they were going to get was this mythology that had been developed by French artists and writers and then these newspapers and government propaganda, that, they would show up and someone would give them land and then they would be able to support themselves.
Right.
And they don't necessarily think they're going to be able to support themselves without doing any work. The letters that I found in the local archives in France from people who were interested in migrating, were people who wanted to work and couldn't support their families. In particular, men were very concerned that they couldn't support their families doing their profession in the place where they came from. So they saw Algeria as an opportunity to do that, to live honorably by their own labor. Mm-hmm. And they got there and some of them were able to do it. There are tens of thousands of men employed on these public works projects. But that's a fairly temporary source of employment. And in general, people found that they couldn't necessarily support themselves. You needed a lot of capital in order to develop agricultural land. And so a lot of the people who emigrated to Algeria in the early period ended up coming back to France at mm-hmm. some point, although we don't know exactly what the return rates were, except that the turnover was very high. So generally, it was what they found was disappointing, was quite out of inconsistent with the expectations mm-hmm. that they had.
Mm-hmm. And how were they? This may be a dumb question. I got to ask it anyway. How were they received?
By the Algerian population?
Yeah, by the Algerian population. Was there an active resistance, or did people spit on them? Or, how are they, what I'm just trying to imagine what the context must have felt like when they arrived.
Yeah. Well, there certainly is an active resistance, and I realize I've been talking about the settlement colonization piece and not so much about the military piece. The title of the book by Ford and Plow really does try and understand this two-pronged invasion. That's an invasion and sort of an invasion and takeover of the land by settlement, but also a military invasion and occupation. And so, yes, there is certainly military conflict between Algerians, particularly led by two leaders, Ahmed, who is the Bey of Constantine in the east, and then a religious leader and political leader named Abdelkader, who was centered in the western part of Algeria, leading armies fighting with the French army, but also tribes allied with these resistance leaders, attacking European farms and areas where Europeans were settling. So there certainly is violence, a lot an enormous amount of violence in Algeria in this period. But what we don't know very much about yet is the more everyday kinds of encounters. What was life like? How did Algerians and Europeans interact on a daily basis in the places where they were in contact with one another? We don't really know very much beyond the fact that Algerians were employed, for example, by European landowners to do agricultural work. Or that Algerians worked, did all kinds of menial labor and provided all kinds of services in the colonial cities.
Oh. What sort of status did the Algerians themselves have once the French arrived?
The Algerian population were what were called colonial subjects. So they were considered to be subject to French sovereignty, but they essentially had no rights. The capitulation agreement in 1830 had said that the French would respect property rights, religious observance, and civil law. So there's a whole judicial and civil law developed where Algerians are allowed to live under Islamic law with regard to basically private non-criminal matters. In the 1860s, they're accorded French nationality, but not citizenship unless they gave up that civil status.
What the heck does that mean, French nationality, right?
Well,
sounds like something you might not even want to have.
Been trying to figure that one out for historians of citizenship for a while.
Yeah.
It is an extremely ambiguous term. So they are nationals. Concretely, one example of what it means is that when they travel outside of Algeria, they fall under the protection of the French consulate, for example. But few political rights in Algeria itself, and in a lot of ways at the end of the 19th century, it's better to be an Algerian in some place like Tunisia than it is to be an Algerian in Algeria, because in Tunisia they treat you like a Frenchman, whereas in Algeria they treat you like a colonial subject, as opposed to a French citizen.
Go ahead.
The European population begins to get citizenship much earlier, and so to the extent that there is elected representation and citizenship rights in the colonial period in Algeria, it falls mostly to the Europeans.
We're almost out of time, but I want to ask, and again, this is a very open-ended question. We've already discussed it a little bit. What was the legacy of this for later French and Algerian history?
The legacy is enormous, and that is partly why I was so interested in this originary period, is that by being settled according to this 19th century settlement colonization model, Algeria gets integrated into the French national territory. In 1848, Algeria is declared part of the national territory. The settlers, the French citizens, get citizenship rights and representation. And that kind of assimilation of the settler colony to France just increases over time, such that by the 20th century, people say, Algeria is just an extension of France on the other side of the Mediterranean. And what that means in the long term is that the French are much more invested in Algeria than in other parts of their empire, and are much less willing to withdraw, much less willing to give up their presence in Algeria than they are other places. Yeah. So after World War II, when Algerian nationalists begin to demand not just reform and citizenship within the system, but independence, the French, you know, under pressure from the settler population of French citizens, won't negotiate the way they do in sub-Saharan Africa and other places. And that is what makes the war of decolonization so incredibly violent when it breaks out in 1954, doesn't end until 1962. Mm-hmm. You know, the French fight to stay in Algeria. And then that war has an impact in France that's sort of analogous to the impact of the Vietnam War in the United States in terms of the political and the collective trauma of the conflict. Mm-hmm. But it also means that there is a an ability to travel between France and Algeria before independence and to a certain degree after independence that makes for this enormous stream of migration north from Algeria to France. I mentioned the mass exodus of the European population at independence. So you have almost a million Europeans who flood into France in the 1960s. But you also, starting during and then especially after World War I, have Muslim Algerians migrating to France and creating the core of what will become the largest Muslim population in Europe, which is in France. And right. So the conflicts today about the place of Islam in modern French society, about the historical relationship between France and the Muslim populations from particularly North Africa, all stem back to that decision that's made in the very first decades of the conquest to turn Algeria into a settler colony.
Mm-hmm. Well, fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. I hope people go out and buy this book by Sword and Plow, France and the Conquest of Algeria by Jen Sessions, who we've been speaking with today. Jen, we're almost out of time, but I want to take these last precious few moments to ask you our traditional final question on the New Books Network, and that is, what are you working on now? I know you're in France there with a dog in your lap. Presumably you're not just taking care of dogs.
Yes, I actually am working in the Colonial Archives right now, trying to answer some of those questions you were asking just a minute ago about what happens when people, when the Europeans get to Algeria. Mm-hmm. So I'm researching an uprising that took place in Algiers province, not too far from the capital, in 1901. And the prehistory of relations between Europeans and Muslim Algerians in that region, the history of European settlement, the social relations and economic relations, and then the revolt itself, which had a religious characteristic and the debates about the sources of the revolt. Was it was it, according to the settlers, it was just Muslim fanaticism boiling over, as it inevitably would? Was it, as critics, particularly in metropolitan France, of the colonial system started to argue, that Algerians were being economically devastated by the French presence, and so they were simply acting in out of economic frustration and social frustration because of the injustices that they were subject to under the colonial regime. So I'm looking at that revolt and then the trial of the people who participated in the revolt to try and get a better idea of what life was like on the ground in at least one community in colonial Algeria.
Well, it sounds like a great project, and I wish you luck with it. And I want to thank you. We've been talking with Jen Sessions today about By Sword and Plow, France and the Conquest of Algeria. Jen, thanks so much for being on the show, first of all.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, and let me tell everybody that this is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network, and I want to thank you for listening to this podcast, and I hope that you tune in next week. So everybody have a good day. Okay, bye-bye.